Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to today's program at the Commonwealth Club, and thanks for being here. I'm Marisa Lagos. I'm politics correspondent at KQED and co-host of the Political Breakdown podcast. And I'm really excited to be here today with Washington Post journalists Carol Lenning and Phil Rucker, who are Pulitzer Prize-winning writers. They've reported on NSA spying, Secret Service misconduct, and Donald Trump's unprecedented 2016 campaign. Now, as you all probably already know, they have turned their attention to the Trump presidency, and their new book, A Very Stable Genius, Donald Trump's Testing of America, tells the story of a president's first term through a different lens. Rather than being an accidental creature of chaos, they frame Trump's first term as a careful and purposeful pattern of disorder. With in-depth interviews, firsthand witnesses, and previously never before seen material, Lenning and Rucker explore how the president has shaken up alliances, reinvented the presidency, and compromised the integrity of American institutions such as the FBI and others, which we will get into. The book has received extensive coverage in the last couple weeks, including from the president himself, who said via Twitter, his favorite medium, that it is, quote, another fake book by two third-rate Washington Post reporters. So congratulations, you guys. Please join me in welcoming them here today to discuss A Very Stable Genius, President Trump, and more. Welcome, Carol and Phil.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, as you can tell, you guys are in this is good territory for this book, I think. People are very interested in it. I want to start, though. I actually tweeted ahead of time that I actually get more nervous interviewing fellow journalists a lot of times than politicians. That feels like there's more pressure. but I did read the whole book. It's pretty long. There's a lot in there, you guys. I don't know we can get to everything.
But a page turner, I hope.
It is. I mean, it's interesting because you guys really frame this in a narrative way, even though it's pretty chronological, too. So being a journalist, I do want to talk a little bit about the process. You guys write at the outset that this was based on hundreds of hours of interviews, more than 200 sources. Can one of you just talk about why? Why this book? Why now?
So if you've been following the news at all, Phil Rucker and I are friends and colleagues at the Washington Post, and for 3 years we were covering this presidency, Phil longer because he covered the campaign, and it felt like bullets and shrapnel and crazy chyrons were zinging past our temples every day. We would write a huge story together or apart, and it was so shocking what we were reporting, so unprecedented, that we would have forgotten the shocking thing from the day before. And we just wanted to hit the pause button and really go down deep into some of the events that we were witnessing. This was history unfolding right in front of us, and it was something we had never seen before. We wanted, again, to make sense of what's really happening. It can't just be the story of chaos every day, although we wrote a lot about that. It has to be something more. And we found out it was actually, we found out a lot more details from inside the room. And we found out there's a method to the madness, so to speak.
How long did it take? I mean, besides all of your life that you had already given to this presidency before starting the book.
You know, the period of time when we were seriously focused on doing this book was probably about 9 to 10 months.
Okay.
We both took 4 months away from the Washington Post and were focused full time during those 4 months on reporting and researching and writing the book. But to be honest, that was not nearly enough time.
Right.
And so we ended up spending a lot of nights and weekends to get this done. But we felt an urgency with the project because we're living this history every day. We just thought it was so important to get this information out there.
So even if folks here haven't read the book, they've probably read excerpts of it because the Post has published things and a lot of them have made news. I'm curious, as reporters whose like instincts are to break stuff, how did you guys decide, oh my gosh, we need to report this now actually, or we're saving it for the book, or like maybe something in the, like what was that process like?
You know, as a journalist, you've hit a really important but also slightly sensitive topic. And I think Phil and I, you know, struggled with this because we are Washington Post reporters. What do we want to do most in our world and in our lives and in our career? We want to put news in the newspaper. In this case, we followed that to a T, but we had an understanding with our amazing editors, which was, If the details you learn are not just cinematic, if the details you learn really change the nature of what we know about this presidency, if these are things the public needs to know today, you have to come to us. And there were actually a couple instances.
Can you give an example, maybe?
Around the time of the Zelensky call, the famous July 25th call that the president makes to Volodymyr Zelensky and says, I want you to do us a favor, though. The thing that landed him in an impeachment investigation and now in a Senate trial, there were sources that we had who had a lot of information about other foreign calls the president had made that were deeply disturbing to them. They are overwhelmingly Republican national security and intelligence officials, and we pressed upon them that some of this information needed to be in the newspaper right now, and it could not wait for the book.
And I would just add to that one point, which is the process of interviewing sources for the book is different than
right.
with the daily paper.
I want to get into that a little.
There were people we interviewed for the book who never would speak to us for the daily paper, who don't speak to reporters regularly. And they talk to us for the book on the condition that their stories, their accounts are a part of history and will be put into this historical narrative as opposed to in the paper that day. And so we had agreements with certain sources where we couldn't actually use what they were saying for the paper in real time.
So I want to talk a little bit about that, because a lot of the book takes, I don't know, you could say creative license in terms of quoting people, going inside their heads, like sort of ascribing thoughts to different people. But you don't always attribute those to those people. And I think that you probably, being a reporter myself, are playing a delicate dance between people that wanted to be anonymous and people that wanted to be totally off the record versus on background, if you guys want to describe that a little to our non-journalism audience. But I mean, to start with, how did you guys sort of approach the question of anonymity? Because I think that, you know, I can see the argument on both sides. On one side, more information is better. On the other side, does it undercut the strength of the book if people don't know who certain things are coming from?
You know, the anonymous sources question, we welcome, because there are a lot of interesting things to say about it. Phil is exactly right to hit this note about the fact that people who eventually broke their silence with us and told us what really happened in some of the rooms had repeatedly refused to talk to us and our colleagues and our competitors. So we were grateful for it. We write in an omniscient voice, you know, we want to make you feel like it's a movie and you're seeing it, but it has been rigorously vetted. We don't use anonymous sources unless it is consistently backed up by other accounts, calendars. We ask people to go through their email box inbox historically, review your emails and make sure that this really happened on this day and you remember it. There's a scene in which we describe the reaction of some of the officers in the room when the president started barking at everybody and calling them dopes and babies in the Pentagon and called them losers. There are a few officers. We had to go to them and say, was this your reaction? Is this true? They did not want to talk to us, but they fact-checked with us so that we could know that whether or not there was any dispute about that. I have to say that the writing is an incredible incredible task and chore. It's unbelievable to do this, but we almost spent as much time fact-checking it because of those anonymous sources. Yeah. We don't want anyone to feel that there's a dispute with one moment.
But if you read it, Phil, I mean, there's definitely, at least I came away from it thinking I have an idea of some of those people who did talk to you. Is that something you sort of had to negotiate with each individual source in terms of how you frame it and how obvious it might seem that a certain administration official would have actually talked to you guys directly?
You know, we were really careful in how we wrote about different sources, you know, how people reacted in the room, just because we understand how somebody reacted and was thinking about the way the president was bullying them or mistreating them does not mean that they were necessarily direct sources. for this book. I mean, we talked to a lot of people who were briefed about things at the time, who were familiar with how some of the principals thought. And Carol and I, you know, one of the most important things we did in reporting this book was protect the people who were talking to us. They took great risk to tell us what really happened behind the scenes, to tell us what it is that the president said, to show us how it was so much worse than we knew in real time. And they did so because they knew, they trusted us that we would protect them. And so we tried to do that with the book. And that's why we're being a little vague in these
answers. No, totally. But, I mean,
it's the most important thing we do as journalists.
Obviously, Trump, not a fan of the book.
You missed his good line, though, by the way. He called us third-rate reporters, which is better than fourth-rate reporters.
Right.
But he also called us stone-cold losers from the Amazon WP.
Oh.
So we stone-cold losers.
Yeah, stone-cold losers.
That's one. A good one.
If you guys want to suggest any theme music, we're looking for stone-cold loser theme music.
You're going to do an audio version of this book? Maybe a musical?
Yeah.
The next Hamilton. So the book is very tough on Trump, and I feel like very matter-of-fact about his shortcomings. I mean, you guys frame it as, you know, you guys are objective journalists wanting to share the truth with the public. But you also don't pull any punches, I think, when it comes to sort of calling things as you see them in terms of what you've witnessed as Washington reporters prior to this. One example of many is talking about a speech Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was giving to the DEA. And you guys write, he spoke with reverence for the rule of law, that framework of principles that promised impartiality, accountability, transparency, and basic fairness, which Trump was undermining daily. Talk about like how the calculation of that pretty, I think, blunt statement in terms of the umbrella of objectivity, because I think there's often a misunderstanding that objectivity is just letting each side have their say and not making the call.
You know, keep in mind that moment. I'm really delighted you brought that moment up because a lot of we've been interviewed a lot and no one has singled that out. So journalist props to you. That moment is a scene in which Rod Rosenstein is the Deputy Attorney General in the Justice Department, is personally, his reputation of three decades hangs in the balance. He has written a memo that is being cited by the president as the reason to fire Jim Comey, and he doesn't believe that he actually, at least to the sources that we spoke to, he does not believe that he argued for firing Jim Comey, and he doesn't believe it is memo. It's all being sort of served up as he's the justification for this. People are thinking he's a tool of the president, and they're questioning whether their old friend and prosecutor is a kiss-up, essentially. So in this moment when he's giving this speech is a really vulnerable time for him. He's really emotional. And the reason we chose those words was because Donald Trump had, by this point, called the Justice Department the Trump Justice Department. He had threatened Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, multiple times and berated him for recusing himself from that investigation, argued that he should unrecuse himself, which would be like ethically impossible. You can't say I have a conflict and then say, guess what, I don't. And all of these ways in which he was breaking this norm. And the two things come together. Rod Rosenstein being like, oh my gosh, I care about the rule of law. I look like, you know, a schmuck. And the president very much not caring about that.
Yeah. I mean, Carol asked me, like, my impressions, and I thought the two top lines were, one, just how much Trump's mood swings seem to really sort of encompass not just the way the White House operates, but really the way our government has been operating under him. And then, two, this undermining of the intelligence, national security apparatus. But I want to get into that first part, which is he is incredibly abusive, as you guys tell it, to his staff, even people who are long-term allies, who are very close with him. It seems like the kids, as you guys, as everyone calls Ivanka and Jared, seem to be some of the only people who escape that. Are they the only ones? Like,
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, we found, and this is not a new discovery about Donald Trump, right? I mean, we've known for some time that he's abusive to people and that the loyalty goes one way. He expects loyalty and fealty, really, from the people who work for him, but does not give it in return. But what Carol and I found in this reporting is that the abusive management style was so much worse than we knew in real time. He would call Kirstjen Nielsen, his Secretary of Homeland Security, at 5 in the morning to bark orders at her. He would call her late at night after watching Lou Dobbs on Fox News to say, Lou had a great idea for the border, go do it, and then call her at 5 a.m. the next morning to wonder why it hadn't been done. And she had to tell him, sir, you know, people are asleep. Like, the staff of the Homeland Security Department are sleeping right now. It was just... he would berate his staff the way he handled Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, at the end when he fired him while Tillerson was on a diplomatic mission to Africa, which was to clean up the relationship with African countries because Trump had called them S-hole nations. There are just a lot of these episodes in the book that paint a portrait of what he's like as a manager and what he's like leading the government. And it's not us being hard on him or critical of him or taking a side. We're just telling you what happened behind the scenes, and a lot of readers, you know, certainly draw conclusions about that.
I mean, one of the tweets I got from somebody who was obviously pretty liberal was like, how did you manage to make me feel bad for Rex Tillerson? And I do, but it's true, I do think that a lot of people who might disagree with the policies of this administration will feel some sympathy or empathy for even some of the most hardline Jeff Sessions, Kirstjen Nielsen. I mean, you guys write at one point, Nielsen is standing with Trump as he signs this executive order to try to end the separation of children at the border. And at the same time, his administration was circulating a completely different EO than what she thought was being signed.
Executive order, yeah.
Yeah, why? Why? Like, why would he even do that?
You know, there are two really good points that come to mind from your question, or rather two good questions in the thing you just said. I find it really interesting about this presidency. It's something that Phil and I learned in an eye-opening way. Like, even we who had been there from day one were sort of taken aback by this. But these grown-ups that were in the room, so to speak, at the beginning, you may not agree with them politically or philosophically. You may think that their personality style isn't so great. I mean, Rex Tillerson was reviled in many parts of the State Department for wanting to cut the bureaucracy there and reorganize and not being very approachable. But he and John Kelly, first as Secretary of Homeland Security, then as Chief of Staff, Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. These were people who kept telling the president, look, you don't want to do this. Let me tell you why. You don't want to do this. And here's the national security implications if you do this. And the president, in the abusive management style you highlight, drove those people out of the room. And the result was now he is increasingly surrounded by people who view their mission as telling the president, yes, here we are in an impeachment phase of his administration. Not many people get here as quickly as he did. Those many people will ask me, how in the world do these people serve Donald Trump? Well, they have a conservative ideology. They have a philosophy. They hoped to serve this agenda, and they hoped that they would guide the novice, Donald Trump. Yeah. But what they found out was they just got a lion roar in their face every day, and many of them either were driven out or left.
Yeah, and you guys say even after that, Sessions still really admires Trump, it seems like. But before he drove out a lot of those people, I want to go back to that, because it seems like the beginning of his presidency was a lot of meetings where people were trying to just teach him history. Do you guys, I mean, the tank episode, I think, is one of the most striking of that. But talk about one of those and sort of, again, like back to like, what did you guys learn that you didn't know before this reporting about that part of it?
Yeah, so, you know, there was an effort early on, and this predates the inauguration, during the transition, when Trump's advisors tried to transform him somehow into a more traditional president, into somebody who would sort of respect our intelligence community, who would follow protocols, who would uphold alliances and so forth. And they tried for many months into the presidency. The tank scene is the most sort of jarring and dramatic moment, I think, and if you haven't read the excerpt, this is what ran in the Washington Post a week or so ago, where Mattis and Tillerson and Gary Cohn take the president to the Pentagon, to a sacred room, a meeting room where decisions of war and peace are made, and tried to teach him about the world, to show him where our troops are deployed and explain, why do we have so many troops on the Korean Peninsula? Why do we have an alliance called NATO? You know, why are we active in the Middle East, even if we're not at war in some of those parts of the world? And he got really frustrated with the tutorial and snapped at them. And this is, of course, where he called them dopes and babies. But there were other alarming moments for the people who worked for Trump. One was when he made his first trip to Asia in the end of 2017, and they stopped in Hawaii on the way. And the president did what many presidents before him have done, which is pay a visit to Pearl Harbor, to the USS Arizona. And as Donald Trump is with Melania Trump and John Kelly, then his chief of staff, to go out to see the USS Arizona, the president says to Kelly, you know, John, what is this all about? He had heard of Pearl Harbor. He knew that this was the scene of some epic battle, but he didn't know what really happened there. And he didn't know the historic importance of that Japanese attack and how it led us into World War II and how it recast the entire world order. And it just spoke to the fact that Trump came into office to become president without a full understanding or appreciation of the American story and our kind of history and heritage as a nation.
And that was a rare instance where he actually asked too, right? I mean, usually it was him being sort of other people trying to force information down his throat. I want to go back to Secretary Tillerson for a moment, because the sense I have gotten from before reading your book was really that he did try to gut a lot of the State Department, that there was a lot of unhappiness with him within that department. And yet this book really shows a side of him where he stood up to defend the diplomatic and military national security structure. Carol, how do you square those things? Like, because you guys mentioned that some of the negative reporting about the State Department may have been a smear campaign by the White House, but it also seems like there's some legitimate criticisms of his time there, right?
I think there are some legitimate reasons that I've interviewed a lot of people at the State Department. I understand why they felt that his tenure was a little bit traumatic for them, because he was proposing big cuts. He was proposing a reorganization. He wasn't available to them. But remember, he's a C-suite guy. He was the head of Exxon, one of, you know, the largest companies on the globe. And, glad handing with employees, not to dismiss that, was not really in his major wheelhouse. But it is funny to me, it is ironic to me, how much Phil and I learned behind the scenes about what he was dealing with the president, his number one boss. You know, in 2017, he was in a meeting with a random assortment of people in the Oval Office, President Trump, Vice President Pence, a couple other people, and somebody is discussing prosecutions of American businessmen who've been found to have, under intense investigation, have been found to be bribing foreign governments and foreign officials to get business overseas. And the president perks up at this word, bribery, and says, you know, what's up with that? We need to get rid of that bribery law. It's not fair that U.S. companies can't bribe foreign officials. And he looks at Rex Tillerson and says, you know, I want you on that, Rex. Let's figure out how to get rid of that law. Well, Phil and I were, you know, just learning this from various sources, going, wait a minute, Rex Tillerson's Secretary of State, he can't overturn a law. And so then Rex Tillerson basically, jaw on the ground, says, you know, Mr. President, I'm not the guy for that. And according to our reporting, then, you know, the president whips around over to Stephen Miller, who's also in the room, and says, Stephen, let's get an executive order. We need to allow these people to bribe foreign officials. So Rex had his hands full, right? I mean, he's dealing with this, I say first name, that I shouldn't, Secretary of State Tillerson, I'm being colloquial, but he had another episode with the president where he's trying to guide Donald Trump on learning about who is Vladimir Putin. Rex Tillerson has met Vladimir Putin, negotiated with him over all sorts of energy reserves, and he's trying to tell the president, look, this guy is very charming, but he's an operator, and we can try to work with him, but he's going to try to take advantage. He wakes up in the morning looking for where is the weak spot for America and how can I get over there and make it weaker? How can I open up that vein? And as Tillerson is trying to tell the president all this, the president's like, yeah. I don't believe that Putin's trying to do that to us. And then finally, again, as Phyllis and I learn, when the president, first moment he gets a chance to meet Putin, which he's been eager to do since before the inauguration, as soon as he meets him, he says to Rex, I've got this. I know more about Putin than you. So Tillerson, as I say, had his hands full. Sorry for the long answer.
No, it's good. It's like, I think it speaks to, back to the point about like the history lessons, you know, a lot of it too, it seems like are people like Tillerson or even Stephen Miller, who seem to know that that was a ridiculous request, but still said yes to him, which seems to be the case.
Well, and illegal. I mean, right. A legislative branch.
It's not going to happen. But the key to staying in his good graces is to say yes, even if you can't do it. And yeah. Also to like almost tweak their language to his worldview. So like talking about things like, you know, you guys detail how he talks a lot about like, we should be making money off of everything. Like everything is in the frame of economic power.
The generals actually learned that to command his attention, they would put as many dollar signs and monetary figures into the slide presentations, as well as Trump's own name, into the slideshow so that he would be engaged. He didn't read briefing materials at all. So everything was visual, you know, charts, videos, graphics, maps. But if there are dollar signs and Trump's name, he'll pay more attention.
A little bit more. Well, I think this is a good segue to a section of questions I have called authoritarian tendencies. So one thing that struck me, because I think that a lot of people have watched things like his first meeting with Putin, the infamous Helsinki press conference, his dealings with Kim Jong-un, with President of Turkey, Erdogan, sort of surprised. Like, you would think a guy like him might like people that he can push around. But he actually really seems to crave these sort of associations with strongmen. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, he became intoxicated by these strongmen in office from early on. And actually before he took office, he aspired to be part of the club, to be liked and admired by Putin, to be liked and admired by Erdogan of Turkey. There's a moment in the book where one of the president's advisors described how much the president likes talking to Erdogan on the phone, because Erdogan has this really deep, commanding voice. And this advisor said it's like listening to Hitler at a Nuremberg rally, or listening to Erdogan on the phone. But Trump just, he wanted to be a part of that club. He wanted to be seen as strong and have his power in this country, his political power, be unquestioned and unchecked. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why we report in the book that before he even took office, during one of his interviews with the Secretary of State candidate, he interrupted and turned to Reince Priebus, who was set to be his chief of staff, to say, you know, Reince, when can we meet Putin? Can I meet him before the inauguration? And Priebus had to explain, you know, no, that we have one president at a time. It would be improper for you to meet with another foreign president before President Obama leaves office. And by the way, you need to meet with the NATO allies first before you meet with Russia. But he was just fixated on having that bromance, that relationship.
That bromance, really. So you talked about how Tillerson tried to warn Trump. And you guys detail that Helsinki summit and how at the end Trump says, I see no reason why Russia would have essentially hacked the 2016 election. And he tried to walk that back later. He said, look at my notes. I said, wouldn't have. Carl, what do you make of that? Do you think he misspoke? Do
you
think?
You know, our reporting indicates that he didn't misspeak. We also see, if you don't mind, several examples in which basically people have to come to him, and he doesn't like it when this happens, but people have to come to him and say, you're getting killed. You got to do something. And in this case, it was, you're getting killed. They left that event, and I hope I have my great partner to tell me if I miss a nuance here, but they get on Air Force One. They're heading off back to the States, and Trump thinks he's done a great job. He's really proud of himself. He's super psyched. He thinks he's looked tough and strong and smart and in control. And the outrage is pouring in from Republicans who are back home commenting how upsetting this whole matter is, that the president of the United States on foreign soil with an adversary and former KGB agent has dismissed the value and the real facts that have been brought to him by the U.S. intelligence operators. All sorts of people start issuing statements in the Republican Party, and his aides are coming to his stateroom to say, we got to do something. Phil knows chapter two of that better than I, so I'm going to turn to him now.
Well, once they landed back in the U.S., there was a cleanup effort underway, and it took a couple of days. There's a scene in the book where Kellyanne Conway, early the next morning, is in the Oval Office with the president, kind of scrambling to help figure out how to correct the statement and how Trump can show that he supports the intelligence community when our reporting shows, in fact, he never did and never really has believed them.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Learn about our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for any of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now back to our program.
He sort of did the same thing with Kim Jong-un, right, in terms of in their 2019 meeting with Otto Warmbier, yeah, where he basically took his word for it. I mean, is that kind of part and parcel of this, like, intoxication with power, do you think, like, where he just wants to believe these people because he looks up to them?
There are two things that I would emphasize about that. One, if we can go back to Putin for a moment, there's a reason, and H.R. McMaster told many people this, and they told us. H.R. McMaster used to always say to his staff, National Security Advisor, I don't understand why the president can't accept this information and why he loves Putin so much. I don't understand why he wants to buddy up with him. But he would say, you know, the president cannot accept that they try to interfere in the election, because that gets onto a slippery slope of it could have had an impact on the election, and that would then be the slippery slope to maybe I wasn't really as great a candidate as I'm telling everybody I was. So those things, that is all in a line. He can't accept that information, according, again, to his own conservative senior aides. This issue of other autocrats that he goes along with, you know, I think of the scene that we report in the book involving Erdogan. Again, that voice from Nuremberg over the phone.
That is so... I actually have a note in here, like, just the voice thing. That's such an interesting...
He dug that guy, and not exactly the best ally of the U.S., but he knew how to flatter the president. He knew how to work the president. The president thinks he's the best deal maker ever. But Erdogan is on the phone with him in November of 2018 and saying, you're supporting people over there that are terrorists. They're coming across my border. I need to put up a wall. They're coming across from Syria. You're helping fund these people, and they're criminals and they're terrorists and they're hurting us. And on the phone, like lickety-split, you hear the word border and wall and terrorists, and the president goes, it's a bunch of dirt, take it. Meaning we're going to get out the U.S. troops who've been fighting ISIS, who've been helping an allied sort of group of the SDF, a group of fighters. We're going to get out of there and we're going to withdraw. And that is the last straw for Mattis. And literally that day, he starts making his plans for leaving.
Excuse me. Did that come after the sort of botched prisoner swap situation?
It
as
did.
Well,
come,
it I was did. Not. Was that something that you guys sort of really uncovered through this reporting? Like the details of that. If you want to talk about that a little bit, it was pretty remarkable to me.
We have a lot more details about, again, the president's view of himself as the ultimate deal maker in this moment. The Washington Post, at the Washington Post, we wrote a lot of these stories too, but
it's hard to keep up, as you guys know.
we try to beat ourselves.
Yeah. Totally.
So the Post did, I think, a pretty good job of covering this, but we learned new things, and those new things included that the president, again, thinking that he is so good at negotiating, is on the phone with Erdogan. He calls him out of nowhere while he's golfing in Scotland and at his own resort where he's staying. And he calls him and says, look, I need this. I need this guy out. Pastor Brunson, who's a conservative American pastor. I need him out of there. What'll it take? Well, the president is doing all this sort of freelancing because his entire government back at home, the State Department, the military, the national security agencies have all been making a plan for how to get this pastor back with a series of steps. But the president kind of bifurcates that. And when he does, he gives Erdogan the impression that Erdogan can get something more than what they've negotiated. And they don't release Branson as quickly as the president expected. And then he starts fuming and screaming and tweeting when Branson's not released as he expects.
I just want to say, I have a lot of audience questions and they kind of fit into a couple of buckets. One of them is about being reporters and one is about kind of politics moving forward. So I am going to get to them, but I feel like we need to spend a few minutes on the Mueller investigation and report since that is a big part of this presidency. So one of the things, there's a lot of details in here about Bob Mueller and his team, and you know, he's such this like sort of cloaked in secrecy figure. So that was really interesting. And one thing that struck me was his few interactions with Steve Bannon. He really kind of seemed to have Bannon's number in a way that we haven't heard about other people. Can one of you guys describe those interactions and sort of why they ruffled Bannon?
Yeah. So the first time Bob Mueller met with President Trump was before the special counsel was appointed.
Right.
Trump had fired Jim Comey as the FBI director, and there was an effort to bring Mueller in as a former FBI director to talk to Trump to explain to him what qualities do you look for in an FBI director? Why is it important that the FBI is independent politically from the White House, which is something Trump didn't sort of fully grasp. Trump, of course, thought it was a job interview, thought Mueller was auditioning to be FBI director. He did not want the job. This was an effort to try to persuade Trump about the integrity and independence of the FBI. So as Mueller's being brought in through a secret door into the Oval Office, right outside the Oval Office, Bannon is sitting at or hovering over a desk with Hope Hicks, the communications advisor, in a little anteroom right outside the Oval. And Mueller comes by and introduces himself to Steve Bannon, knew who he was, of course, the famous guy, Bannon. But interestingly knew that Bannon's daughter had, and I don't want to botch this, had like matriculated to the Air Force Academy. Is that right? One of the academies.
She was at West Point instead of at Annapolis, I think.
West Point instead of Annapolis, and had some small talk about that. And Bannon was blown away that Mueller knew that, because that's not something that had been in the press. It's not something that was sort of out there on the internet. It was just something Mueller would have picked up through word of mouth through the law enforcement community. And Bannon thought to himself in that moment, like, wow, this guy's good. He did his research. And, fast forward a couple of days, and of course, Mueller is appointed the special counsel, and it becomes all the more terrifying for Bannon and the other people in the White House. And then fast forward even further, and Bannon comes into the special counsel sanctum, the secret office.
I love this story.
In D.C. To do his interview, to be deposed by the special counsel team. And he walks into the room with his lawyer, Bill Burke, and there are like 25 FBI agents in the room waiting to interview him. And Bannon freaks out and gets stage fright and walks right out of the room and says to his lawyer, holy crap, what's going to happen here? Like, did Reince have like 25 people when he came in to do his interview recently, Reince Priebus? And the lawyer said, no. It's because you're like Darth Vader. Everybody wants to see you be deposed. And so everybody who worked on the special counsel team wanted to be in that room at that moment to watch Steve Bannon answer the questions.
It seemed like Mueller both was also trying with and he, I think at that point he also mentioned the daughter again, like something
he said,
yeah. she'll be happy that she went back to West Point. It seems like Mueller was trying to get under his skin, but also you guys remind Bannon that he had been a member of the military himself.
And establish for Bannon that he has more of a connection with the people in that room, with the law enforcement community, with the FBI folks doing this investigation than he does with Donald Trump. Yeah. And to make Bannon feel like he had a common language with the investigators.
I mean, you guys mentioned that Trump has seen everything about Russia in 2016 in this Mueller report as an attempt to undermine the legitimacy of his election. I'm curious, after all these conversations and, you know, reporting on the president, do you think he truly believes that they weren't part of it, or that he just doesn't want to talk about that?
I feel like we kind of have addressed it in the sense that I just think he's walled that off because it, according again to the aides who've tried to impress upon him, everybody has been in a room with him trying to say, look, it really happened. I think he's walled that off. We don't know his heart and his mind other than what is reflected through all the people around him. And they say he cannot accept it because it gets down to, was my election legitimate?
And along the same lines, another thing that he had trouble accepting even early on, and there's a scene in the book about this, is that he lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by 3 million votes. And
let's talk about our congresswoman from San Francisco, Nancy Pelosi.
Should I keep going?
Go for it. Yeah.
So there's a moment right after the inauguration when the president has the congressional leaders over to the White House for a reception, a kind of get to know you event, and Pelosi, then the minority leader, was there, and Trump starts talking in the event. She thought, by the way, he was going to strive for some unity and quote the Bible or say something about common values. It's the Democrats and Republicans
olive
together,
yeah.
An olive branch of some kind. And instead, he started going on about how there were 3 to 5 million illegal votes that were cast, many of them in California. How he really won the popular vote, and Pelosi stood up and had to interrupt him and say, that's not true. And I'm paraphrasing here, but that's not true. And how can we work together if we're not accepting the same set of facts? And it was a moment where she confronted him in private, and the people who worked for the president were really surprised by that. And Steve Bannon whispered to some of his fellow advisors in the White House, Pelosi's going to get us. She's a total assassin. She's going to get us.
I have that written down. I'm glad you went into that. So, Carol, what do you think, watching from very afar here on the West Coast, obviously Pelosi has a lot of fans here, and I think she, better than a lot of people in Congress, has done a good job at pushing back, whether it was that meeting, several others that have all become memes, basically. But
one of her best lines, though, ever, I mean, I'm a mom, was when she said, I'm a mother of 5 and a grandmother of 8. I've got those numbers wrong. I know a tantrum when I saw it. You know, she can really get under Donald Trump's skin in a way nobody else can. And the assassin moment is part of it. She Maureen Dowd had a column a couple of days ago, I think, and she talked about how women who are in politics talking about gender and misogyny and sexism and real issues. And she's like, Pelosi is just like, I don't got time for that. I'm just doing business.
Yeah.
And
do you think, I mean, he seems to almost grudgingly respect her.
Yes.
Is that fair?
Because she's tough.
Yeah. And she does seem to be sort of one of the few people who's been able to navigate that. Although I do wonder if those feelings have slightly changed since the impeachment thing took off. He just seems angrier now.
Sure. I mean, he blames her for sure. Absolutely. He's come at her for.
But there's a reason he picks on Adam Schiff so much more than Nancy Pelosi, because he sees vulnerability in a lot of the men on the Democratic side. But he, according to our reporting, in some ways fears her. He views her as very effective, very strategic. And, you know, he calls her Nervous Nancy or whatever on Twitter. But he doesn't really cut deep the way he does with other Democrats.
Yeah. I want to go back to Mueller just for one more question, which is, you guys write in the very opening of the book that a lot of people felt like Mueller got outfoxed. And you detail throughout the book, you know, that there was this long dance around whether Trump would actually sit down with his investigators and give a face-to-face interview. It was the subject of probably dozens and dozens of attorneys who filtered through the White House. He couldn't get a lawyer at one point. That's a
several
whole
rounds of legal teams.
But you know, ultimately Mueller decided not to subpoena him, to force him to sit down. They accepted written questions, and he made the call not to explicitly say that he felt that the president had obstructed justice in his final report. Spoiler alert, you explain this in the book, but why do you think ultimately that's where Mueller landed?
Well, two things were going on. One is, I actually, from a legal standpoint, not to be a nerd, I don't think his reasoning for not subpoenaing the president was based probably on law and not about being outfoxed. But Bob Mueller was outfoxed based on our reporting in a couple of ways. And they really happened towards the end of the report. There was a lot of dissension and disagreement, quiet and under wraps and hidden from us, but a lot of disagreement within that vault of the Mueller investigation about how far would they go in describing the president's acts of obstruction or things that appeared to meet the standard for charging someone with obstruction if they weren't the president. In 4 of 10 episodes, they found substantial evidence of obstruction, and the team wanted to say that, as some members of the team wanted to say that as well as they could and as hard as they could. And Bob Mueller was like, "No, we're not going to do that. We're not going to qualify the president's actions and say whether or not we would have charged him were it not for him being a sitting president. You can't charge a sitting president. But did his acts rise to the level of a crime under their evidence base?" So that was one decision he made that his team didn't entirely agree about. They weren't too happy about it, some members at least. The second outfoxing was Bill Barr versus Bob Mueller. And that was actually, in the view of many of the members of the team, a tragic moment, because the person who was working in a 1950s dragnet, just the facts, Justice Department, blind justice, you know, scales of justice, that was Mueller. The person who was operating in the Trump world, Twitter, grab the megaphone, own it, was Bill Barr, interestingly. They're friends. They were friends. I don't know where they are now. They are peers. They've gone to each other's children's weddings. But in that moment, Bill Barr was operating one way, and he got the best of Bob Mueller.
Okay, we have a lot of people in the audience who are really worried about you guys in terms of your personal safety and how hard you work. So I
thank you, guys.
Seriously, I have like numerous questions who are like, they see you on MSNBC. How do you stay up so late? Do you guys sleep? Are you worried? I think the security question is interesting, though. Like, have you guys had credible threats? Like, do you feel, has this reporting ever put you in situations that make you feel unsafe?
I will say, without getting into much detail, there have been moments where we've been threatened, and the Washington Post does an incredible job with security and protocols and finding ways to protect us. And, you know, we're really grateful for that. But it is a dangerous time. And I go to a lot of Trump rallies as part of my job covering the White House. And to be honest with you, there's nothing scarier than being in that press pen in the floor of an arena with 20,000 people and to have the president point at you in the pen and say, they're the scum of the earth. They're despicable people. They're the enemy of the state. And to have supporters turn around and flash a finger or hiss at you. And thank God nothing worse has happened so far. But there are a lot of moments at those rallies where I and Carol and our colleagues really do worry that somebody could do something crazy.
On a lighter note, they want to know if you guys ever take a day off. You do, right? No, never.
We do.
What do you? She's all now.
He has been at my house every weekend working on this book.
Somebody wants to know how Republican media has responded to the book, and then there's another question. And I think this gets to process, but it's interesting. Like, does your book contain any classified information? Like Bolton's future book, did it have to be reviewed by Trump? Talk about those things.
I mean, We were not in Bolton's situation. We weren't handed the presidential brief every morning, so we didn't have to go through a pre-public.
Although someone wants to hand it to us, we'll take it. We'll take it.
They've described it. That is classified, but you know, we didn't have to go through, legally speaking, didn't have to go through a pre-publication review with the White House as he does. However, there is a lot of sensitive material in the book and a lot of sensitive material in our reporting, and we think long and hard about, are we revealing something that's too much, that's going to put anybody in danger? Sources, methods, those are important to us, so we think about that. But about pre-publication review, we have a pretty rigorous pre-publication review, me and Phil, and it is, we are not going to get anything wrong. We are going to try our absolute darndest, even though we take, as you use the word creative license, I wouldn't call it exactly that, but it's close. We try to show you what it was and what it felt like, and we have people tell us, what did he say? What did you say? What did the next person say? What did your boss say? And we give you that dialogue because we want you to feel the way it felt. But when we couldn't get consistency about the dialogue, we didn't use it.
And you asked, somebody also asked about how it's being received in Republican media. And one of the most gratifying things, and the book's only been out for about a week and a half now, so, you know, knock on wood, we hope it continues. But the most gratifying thing for us is that this book is not only popular on the coasts, it's not only popular in San Francisco and Seattle and New York and Washington, but it's selling out in Ohio and Texas and Arizona, in a lot of red states. And, you know, it's flying off the shelves at Walmart, as well as at Barnes & Noble and at Books A Million, as well as Costco, and that's really gratifying.
So we can tell who you guys vote for by where you shop, apparently. No. I have like five questions on this, which is really sort of this, I think, central question that a lot of Democrats have been asking themselves for years, which is like, why has the Republican establishment stayed with Trump? I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for the judges and the policies and power itself. But it did strike me reading this, like how deeply he has sought to undermine specifically the intelligence community. And given the past 20 years of Democratic and Republican sort of fights over whether to be hawks and like, I don't know, that does surprise me that that hasn't done more to make people speak out.
Go ahead.
I think that the Republican reaction to Donald Trump, because he's not really a Republican, right? In the philosophical sense of the word, the Republican reaction to him is very similar to the Republican advisor sources that we spoke to. A lot of the reasons they stick with him is because they are hoping he's the vehicle for their agenda. But another reason they stick with him and don't come at him is they're afraid of him. He has a megaphone like nobody's business. You know, we joke about being called stone cold losers because we know, you know, we're not. But it is also a little bit frightening that the president can tell millions of people they're bad. Let me tell you, I'm the guy and they're bad. And I understand because we've watched some of these people experience the withering, derisive commentary on Twitter and other places. Look at Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. I don't know if this is a name that resonates with you, but it does. A Purple Heart recipient who is guilty of what? He was guilty of being subpoenaed and complying with a legal subpoena to appear before the House impeachment inquiry and telling the truth about what he experienced when he was doing his job, listening on the phone call between President Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky. And what did he hear? He heard a U.S. president asking a foreign government to investigate an American citizen and to help with a domestic election. And he was troubled and immediately went to the White House lawyer. Well, the president has come at him on Twitter multiple times. And the military has been assessing the threat to him and considering putting him, his wife, his brother, and his sister-in-law all on a military base to keep them safe. So, sorry to go on, but the fear is real. You know, our wonderful colleague and role model in many things, Bob Woodward, titled his book Fear, and I get why that is the case. There are a lot of people afraid.
How would you characterize both of your relationships with the White House, the president, the people around him?
It's an interesting question. I've covered Trump from the beginning of his campaign and know him. I've interviewed him several times, and the relationship is like this all the time, right? So there are moments...
So you're in good company.
Yeah, so there are moments where he's incredibly solicitous, and you go in to interview him, and he wants to make sure... You know, we have our Diet Coke, and he wants to answer every question we have. And
you just automatically get, like, Diet Coke and a steak when you walk in there?
He has a red button on the Resolute desk, and you'd think it would be, like, to fire a nuclear weapon, but it's actually to get a Diet Coke from the butler. So he just presses the button.
Okay. But if you don't like Diet Coke, is that held against you? Or you just take the Diet Coke?
Just take it.
The Diet Coke.
You just deal with it. You know, there was one time I interviewed him where about an hour, or not interviewed him, I was in a press conference asking questions at Bedminster, New Jersey at his golf club, and about an hour later, as I'm in the van to go back to our hotel, I got a call from Hope Hicks, his spokeswoman, who said, you know, the president asked me to call to make sure you got all the answers you need. Do you have any other questions? I mean, that's crazy. Fast forward to this book, and he agreed initially to do an interview with us. We thought it was so important to have his perspective in this book, to run all these events by him, to understand why he did what he did, why he says he did what he did, and have his account. And he agreed to do an interview. He thought we were serious journalists. He thought this would be a serious book. He wanted to participate. And the relationship got so hostile as we were finishing the book that he backed out of that.
And was that because
of he did not do an interview with us.
Do you think that's because of the reporting on the book or just broadly that you're reporting?
It was broadly our reporting at the Washington Post. He's attacked both of us by name on Twitter for stories we've done in the Washington Post around that time.
I'm a lowlife, by the way, but not Phil.
I'm a nasty lightweight. So.
Besides, like, the Sean Hannitys of the world, is there anyone who has a good relationship with... I mean, like, I know Maggie Haberman has covered him since even before the politics, but...
Everybody who's a legitimate, credible, mainstream journalist who's holding him accountable for his actions and asking serious, tough questions and writing fair coverage has a love-hate relationship with him. There's no journalist who operates at that level that he adores. He wants fawning coverage. That's what he expects. And unless you're going to be like some of these cable news hosts, kind of commentators who give him that fawning coverage, you're never going to be fully loved and admired by the president. And we don't aspire to be loved and admired by him.
That's not our job, which is not always understood by people, especially executives, about journalists. But that's a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about current events because we are in the middle of an impeachment hearing and there's been some other sort of interesting things. And I think what you just said is an interesting entree into the dust up between the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and my sort of colleague by far, Mary Louise Kelly.
An incredible reporter.
Yeah, and I would really encourage people to listen to that entire interview. It's not very long. It's like 5 or 10 minutes. For those of you who don't know, which you probably all do, but she went in to interview the Secretary of State. She turned the conversation from Iran, which he also wouldn't answer questions really directly about, to Ukraine. He got very upset. He ended the interview. He then took her off tape and berated her and has really spent a lot of time attacking her in recent days. Can you guys talk about that? I mean, Pompeo's always been seen as bombastic and I think has had some of these like Trumpian tendencies, but it seems like in these situations, people like him are really playing to this audience of one without any thought to what that could do to the department they're working for.
I mean, you know, without getting into Mike Pompeo as a person and an individual, I mean, how many people who work for Donald Trump have done things where, as reporters, we're all sitting in the room watching it going, wait a minute, that person's only talking to Donald Trump. That person is doing this, it feels like, to please one person. And, you know, Mike Pompeo did please Donald Trump because the other day after, forgive me, I want to revise and just say what that event was about. Mary Louise Kelly was basically yelled at for asking a basic question. And later off camera, when Pompeo had her alone and they weren't being tape recorded, he threw down a map, had a staffer bring in a map with no lines on it and said, you know, does anybody effing care? You think the American people effing care where Ukraine is? You know, can you even point it out on the map? Well, Mary Louise Kelly has a, you know, major graduate degree in European studies. Not only does she know where it is, she knows how many people live there. She can probably draw the map. I'm sure there are a lot of Americans that can't point it out, but it was an interesting kind of it sure appeared bullying, and to a woman who was quite good at what she does. But then the president celebrated Mike Pompeo the other day for doing just that. And in a public setting said, you know, you really did a number on her, and grinned and chuckled. And what are we encouraging in our administration officials and our cabinet members if you get an attaboy for that?
And keep in mind that the Secretary of State is an ambassador of American values abroad. And one of our most important values in this democracy is the freedom of the press. And there are a lot of countries that he visits and other leaders that he speaks with who don't have a free press in their country. And historically, the Secretary of State has been at the forefront in defending the freedom of the press and promoting that value abroad. And for him to treat an NPR reporter that way in such a bullying fashion is a real shame for our democracy.
I mean, that, I think, brings up questions back to the sort of authoritarian tendencies about what could be the long-term implications of this presidency, regardless of whether Democrats take back the White House. His lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, was in the House or in the Senate yesterday basically arguing that essentially if Trump did something to get himself reelected, that is in service of the public good. Is that a fair assessment of it? I mean, it was a very... remarkably sweeping view of executive power, I would say, beyond what we've even seen previously.
It reminds me of something one of Nixon's aides said, which is, if the president does it, it's legal.
Right. Do you guys think that this, again, putting Trump aside, assuming the Senate does vote to acquit him, what will that mean for the presidency in your mind in terms, like, has this set parameters that we can't reverse?
I mean, I, Phil and I could both answer this question easily, which is, you know, we don't know. We can't speculate. We're journalists. We write about what has happened because we want to tell you about it, and you can use it to make your own conclusions. However, we interviewed a person in the firmament of national security, definitely Republican, conservative leaning, who told us something that I thought was really poignant. Does anybody have a copy of the book? Thank you so much. Whoops. And I remember this person, because Phil and I were both really taken aback by what they had to say. It was after the president threatened to take away the security clearance of John Brennan, the former CIA director. He didn't like what John Brennan was saying on television and in interviews about the president. And it made a lot of people in the intelligence community, usually run from reporters, run from cameras, it made a lot of them furious and upset. Like, you can't attack intelligence community for bringing you facts. You can't attack them for telling you what's really going on, which is that Russia interfered in our election and did it not necessarily at the beginning to elect Donald Trump, but did it to unbalance our democracy. Anyway, that moment was pivotal, not just for the country, in my view, but pivotal for Phil and for me and our reporting, because Billy McRaven, the top dog special operator, a legend who led the raid that killed Osama bin Laden, is, you know, collegial friends with Brennan. And he came out of the woodwork and said, I'm writing a letter directing it to the president, and he dictated it over the phone from Colorado and gave it in a voice message machine to one of our colleagues and said, use it as you see fit. Basically said, Mr. President, you know, if you're going to take away John Brennan's security clearance, then come and take mine. I'll be honored for you to take mine. You've embarrassed me. You've embarrassed the country. It's embarrassing to our children. You need to rely upon your intelligence community. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. But that led people in the lower ranks to say, wait a minute, is the bar low, going so low now that you're going to be allowed to attack people for bringing you facts? And this is what the person said. My headset, I think I pulled it off, and I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Cool. The disdain he shows for our country's foundation and its principles, the disregard he has for right and wrong. Your fist clenches, your teeth grate, the hair goes up on the back of your neck. I have to remind myself I said an oath to a document in the National Archives. I swore to the Constitution. I didn't swear an oath to this jackass. The time is coming. Our nation will be tested. Every nation is. Rome fell. Remember, he's opening up vulnerabilities for this to happen. And that is my fear. And I read this not to say I agree with this person, but it was like almost like a break in a dam when this all happened, because people were like, if we're going to start attacking the fact givers, the way our democracy is set up, experts bring us information. If we're going to do that, how much lower are we going to go?
We just have time for about one more question. So I know you guys aren't going to opine on 2020, so I won't even ask. You don't want to tell, you don't want to tell these guys who's the best suited Democrat to beat Trump. Given all the deep reporting that you guys did on the Mueller report, following this impeachment, you know, questions really that have arisen since you tried to end the book in July, do you think from a legal perspective that we could see a prosecution of Trump when he leaves office? Is that something that Mueller thought about? And I mean, I'm sure he thought about it, but that you guys are privy to.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Neither Carol nor I is a lawyer. We're not lawyers. We're not trained to be able to answer that in legal detail.
I guess more based on your conversations with those who have.
Based on our reporting, I mean, this is a political decision that the next administration would have to make. And it does not appear that any of the Democrats running for office would actually want to do this, in part because it would be such a divisive thing for the country. The candidates have been asked this question and have offered various answers. I mean, most of them believe he should be removed from office, believe he should be impeached, believe that what he did in obstructing justice through the Russia investigation was a crime, but whether to actually prosecute him once he's out of office and create all of the political dynamics that would entail in terms of alienating his supporters, his tens of millions of supporters, is another question
altogether.
So it's
political more than a legal case.
I would say I'd be very surprised if that were to happen.
Yeah. Maybe I lied. One more question. Carol, do you think Trump will accept a defeat, a victory?
People always ask this, like he's going to have a third term already.
He literally tweets about having a third term.
Yeah.
I mean, Donald Trump's not going to go anywhere. And when I say that, I mean, he's always going to be sharing with us how he feels if he's not reelected or if he wins a second term. And I can't really like foreshadow that far out in the distance, but it's a good question. I would just say we'll know what Donald Trump is thinking no matter what.
And there is real concern among some Democratic leaders that if he were to lose this November, and especially if he were to lose narrowly, that not only could he claim voter fraud or the election was rigged or something went wrong, but that he might not accept the defeat, and that what could that mean in January of 2021? I mean, it's something that a lot of Democrats in Washington are whispering about and talking about.
We're going to have to leave it on that note. Thank you so much, Carol Lenning and Philip Rucker, authors. They are, of course, authors of A Very Stable Genius. We've also like to remind our audience that pre-signed copies of the book are available for purchase outside the room. I'm Marisa Lagos. On behalf of myself, the Commonwealth Club, Carol and Philip, thank you, everyone, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for supporting journalism.